National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Hey, good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, November 29th, 2023, and you've joined us for National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. We get together every Wednesday here on KYMN Radio to discuss national security, and we're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to explore national security challenges and opportunities. At the beginning of November, I promised we'd do a series of shows covering the Central Asian Republics. We started the series with our guests Esfandyar Batmanghelidze and Timur Umarov as we covered Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. We're continuing our discussions today with a special focus on Kazakhstan, but I'm certain the other Central Asian republics will definitely figure into our dialogue. With us to explore Central Asia is Professor Jeff Mankoff. Jeffrey Mankoff is a distinguished research fellow at the U.S. National Defense University's Institute for National Strategic Studies. Mankoff is also a non-resident senior associate with the Center for Strategic and International Studies Russia and Eurasia program. His areas of expertise include international security, Russian foreign policy, regional security in the Caucasus and Central Asia, ethnic conflict, and energy security. Before coming to the Center for Strategic and International Studies, he served as an advisor on U.S.-Russia relations at the U.S. Department of State as a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow. From 2008 to 2010, he was Associate Director of International Security Studies at Yale University and an Adjunct Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is the author of Russian Foreign Policy, The Return of Great Power Politics. He also published Empires of Eurasia, How Imperial Legacies Shape International Security, which examines the impact of the imperial past on Chinese, Iranian, Russian, and Turkish politics and foreign policy. Dr. Mankoff has also taught courses on international security, Russia, and Central Asia at Columbia, George Washington, Georgetown, and Yale universities, and held academic fellowships at Harvard, Moscow State, and Yale. He holds dual Bachelor of Arts degrees in International Studies and Russian from the University of Oklahoma, and a Master of Arts and a Master of Philosophy and a Doctorate in Diplomatic History from Yale University. Professor Jeff Mankoff, welcome to National Security This Week.
Thank you.
And where are you seated this morning while we're on Zoom with each other?
I'm in my office at the campus of National Defense University in Washington.
All right. Anything happening at NDU today that's of interest, or is it just a typical academic day?
It's a typical academic day. Wednesday's the day when students have their electives, so there'll be a lot of people running around going to courses today.
All right. So, Professor Mankoff, you're currently at the National Defense University as a distinguished research fellow. We should highlight the fact that what we're going to talk about today, these are your views. You're not representing the official position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, or the National Defense University. Could you tell us a little bit more about NDU, just so our listeners understand what that institution is, which colleges are embedded inside NDU, and how that school serves America's long-term national security interests?
Sure. So NDU is part of the Department of Defense. It's what's called a Joint Professional Military Education, or JPME, institution. In that sense, it's similar to the service war colleges. You have the Army War College, Navy War College, Air War College. NDU has a focus on jointness. So we have students who are drawn from all the branches of the U.S. military, DOD civilians, and civilians from other components of the U.S. government. The service members are mostly at the 06 level, so lieutenant colonels, commanders, and they have to go through what's called JPME2 or advanced JPME curriculum to be considered for promotion to higher ranks. NDU is physically located at Fort Leslie McNair in Washington, D.C., and there's a South Campus in Norfolk, Virginia. We're made up of five colleges. There's the National War College, the College of Information and Cybersecurity, College of International Security Affairs, which focuses on irregular warfare. It's the Dwight Eisenhower School, which is kind of NDU's business school, focuses on the economy and mobilization. And then down in Norfolk, we have the Joint Forces Staff College.
And we should highlight JPME stands for Joint Professional Military Education. That's passed into statute a long time ago that all officers in the military have to go through JPME Phase 1 and Phase 2 to be eligible for promotion to flag or general officer rank. So it's a critical part of the training process for all military officers to go through that. Professor Menkoff, your academic specialization has been predominantly on Russia and, by extension, due to the days of the Soviet Union, the role of the Central Asian republics. I mentioned in my opening we'd be concentrating on Kazakhstan today, but likely touching on the other Central Asian republics as well. But I want to start with this question. What drew you to study Central Asia as part of your academic pursuits? It's an area that not too many people understand. You don't hear that much about it in the news. You know about it, obviously, if you're from the region, like one of my previous guests, Timur Umarov, was from Uzbekistan. He's a Tajik living, originally from Uzbekistan. So for an outsider to decide to focus academically on studying Central Asia, there was likely some sort of a catalyst for that. So what was that catalyst for you?
Well, like a lot of people from my generation, I think, started by focusing on Russia around the time of the Soviet collapse. But the more you look at Russia and Russian foreign policy, the more I came to recognize that it was connected in really important ways to the legacy of the Soviet Union. And the collapse of the Soviet Union was still critical for making sense of how Russia positioned itself as an international actor. And so I wanted to focus a little bit more on the other parts of the former Soviet Union to understand what their ongoing connections with Russia were and how they were seeking to establish themselves internationally as independent players in the wake of the Soviet collapse. And so I was primarily interested in Central Asia just because it had I guess in some ways the most complex history in terms of its role at the center of the sort of Turco-Mongol world in the Middle Ages and into the early modern period, and then having that region come under the control of the expanding terrestrial empires surrounding it, of which Russia was the largest and the most successful. And then looking at how the indigenous cultures and identities and ideas survived the experience of both Russian colonialism and then the Soviet experience. So it's always been, to me, a really fascinating region and one that I think is more important in terms of the sort of global strategic balance than it's often understood to be in the United States, because for the U.S. As a country and as far as U.S. national interests are concerned, Central Asia sometimes gets short shrift just because of where it's located. It's far away. The countries there are relatively small. We don't have robust trading relationships with them. And they're in a tough neighborhood with Russia, China, Iran, and other big countries surrounding them and seeking to influence their politics.
Yeah, and so we're going to concentrate on Kazakhstan today. If you feel like, to better explain things that are happening in Kazakhstan by branching out into talking about some of the other Central Asian republics or Russia or China or whatever you want to do, let's absolutely do that. So let's start with Kazakhstan. Could you tell us a little bit about Kazakhstan? What should people understand about that huge landlocked nation in Central Asia?
Yeah. Yes. So Kazakhstan's an enormous country. It's about the size of Western Europe, but it's relatively sparsely populated. Population's only around 20 million or so people. Much of the country is desert or steppe. And it has a very, very long, basically unguardable border with Russia. The population at the time of independence, Kazakhs comprised less than 50% of the population. Mm-hmm. That's changed in the 30 plus years since Kazakhstan became independent. But there's still a significant ethnic Russian population, especially in the north along that border. And then in some of the cities, particularly Almaty in the south. So the ethnic composition of the population creates vulnerabilities, and it's something that Kazakh governments over the course of the last 30 plus years have had to be very, very attuned to. You know, the kind of rhetoric that Russian leaders have used around Ukraine about how Ukraine is an artificial state and it belongs to this so-called Russian world. You hear similar rhetoric sometimes used around Kazakhstan and the presence of that ethnic Russian population, especially in the north along the border, is a big vulnerability. And so Kazakh governments, really from the moment of independence, have had a very delicate task of trying to manage their relationship with Russia in a way that didn't invite intervention, but at the same time allowed Kazakhstan to position itself as an independent actor on the global stage and pursue its national interests, which didn't always coincide with those of Russia. I remember once when I was in Kazakhstan doing research, you know, one of the themes that officials I was talking to emphasized was that we want to be Russia's closest partner, because that way they'll trust us and we'll have more freedom of action in other regions and on other issues. We don't want to give Russia any sort of justification for thinking that we're acting against their interests or that we're going to be a problem, because Russia can cause a lot of problems for us. The war in Ukraine has scrambled that calculation a little bit. I think Kazakhstan, like the other Central Asian countries, recognizes that Russia's influence is diminishing, but also that Russia is is more dangerous right now. It has more willingness to use force, to lash out, that we're in a potentially more volatile period. And so it's a particularly tough moment, but one that the government of Kazakhstan is trying to navigate the best it can.
Yeah, that's a great way to frame it. It feels like Russia, the Russian political leadership, especially Vladimir Putin, as they're feeling the pressure of this moment in history. Most of it self-created. So for our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Professor Jeff Mankoff from the National Defense University, and we're discussing Central Asia. So on our previous show on Central Asia, I asked Tamer Umarov and Esfandiar Batman-Gelij about the political, economic, and security concerns of the other four nations in Central Asia. I'd like to ask you to take us on a bit of a deep dive more deeply into these three areas with regard to Kazakhstan, and maybe start with the political situation inside Kazakhstan and the internal dynamics of Kazakh politics. What can you tell us about how Kazakhstan's political system functions?
Yeah, so Kazakhstan is an authoritarian state. It's a relatively soft authoritarian state compared to some of its neighbors in Central Asia,
like Turkmenistan.
But it's it's still an authoritarian state. The current president has been in power now for a few years. In early 2022, so just a month or so before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there was large scale unrest, particularly in Almaty, the commercial capital and the former political capital, that led to a number of deaths. And President Tokayev actually called for the assistance of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, which is a mutual security body that Russia heads, and that includes Belarus, Armenia, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. And for the first time in its history, the CSTO deployed forces to help put down the unrest in Almaty. That intervention, which was authorized, of course, by Russia, suggested that President Tokayev was very much in Russia's debt and was going to be deferential to Russian political, economic, and security interests going forward. A month later, the war in Ukraine started, and Tokayev and the Kazakh government more generally have charted a much more independent course than I think a lot of observers expected back in January 2022. They have attempted to consolidate power internally. It seems a lot of the unrest in 2022 was connected with supporters of the former president, Nursultan Nazarbayev, who remained kind of a gray cardinal behind the scene after stepping down. Since then, Tokayev has attempted to bring in his own people to kind of shunt Nazarbayev and his supporters to the back, and to sort of use the concerns about stability and about the impact of the war in Ukraine as a justification for people to all kind of rally around the flag and come together to avoid having any sort of negative spillovers in Kazakhstan. That said, I think there are still political vulnerabilities. I talked already about the issue of ethnic Russians. The number of ethnic Russians in the country has expanded since the war began. A number of people have left Russia, fleeing conscription or just out of opposition to the war. Kazakhstan has been one of the principal destinations for those people. The impact hasn't been as serious as it's been in, say, Georgia or Armenia, but nevertheless, there still are issues there. There are also real regional disparities. A lot of the political unrest in Kazakhstan has been centered in the western part of the country, near the Caspian Sea, where much of the energy industry is concentrated, but where there's a lot less wealth and development. Living conditions are poor, salaries are lower, and there's just a sense that people are not that their quality of life hasn't always been a priority for the government, which is seeking to maximize revenues from the energy industry. So that regional volatility, concerns about labor unrest, that kind of thing continues.
So oil and gas, clearly one of the big elements of the economy in Kazakhstan. Anything else that we should know about as far as economic power goes for Kazakhstan?
Uranium. Kazakhstan is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, producer of uranium in the world. And natural resources in general, transportation infrastructure is also really important. I mean, again, you mentioned the size of the country. If you sort of look at where it's located, it's really right at the center of the Eurasian landmass. And I think a lot of transportation routes currently or prospectively that are working to sort of integrate this larger Eurasian space are going across Kazakhstan, and that includes railways, that includes pipelines, that includes highways, electricity transmission lines. So all of those things, but the bulk of the economy remains connected to natural resources, oil, gas, uranium, and a few other things, minerals.
What about Kazakhstan's relationships with the neighboring nations in Central Asia? Maybe we can start with sort of a little bit more about the historical connection to Russia and go from there. I'd particularly like to hear your thoughts on Kazakhstan's relationship right now with China and the other other Central Asian republics.
Yeah, so China is a very important economic partner, has been for quite some time now. China has displaced Russia as the main economic engine for Central Asia for the past decade or so. So as a source of investment, trade, China is really the major player now. The new energy infrastructure that's being built out of the region is mostly going east. So there's a Central Asia-China gas pipeline. It's a series of now four pipelines that cross multiple countries in the region and bring gas to Western China. There's also an oil pipeline running from Central Asia to China. And all of this sort of suggests that the center of economic gravity in the region is shifting. So far, China and Russia have not really had any major conflicts or frictions over Central Asia. They participate in a series of multilateral meetings through organizations like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that are designed to provide a forum for regional cooperation. And China has mostly stuck to the economic realm. It's seeking to develop Central Asia as a source of natural resources for its economy. With some exceptions, has not sought to play a major political or security role in Central Asia. Now, that's beginning to change. The change has happened most extensively in Tajikistan, where you've had for several years now Chinese security forces deployed along sensitive border regions with Afghanistan. And engaged in training and exercises and selling weapons. So we're beginning to see the emergence of a Chinese security presence. But so far, it's not that extensive, especially outside of Tajikistan. And China has, I think, kind of consciously deferred to Russia's role as the main regional security actor. I mentioned before the Collective Security Treaty Organization, or CSTO. This is the umbrella that Russia uses for multilateral security. In many cases, the CSTO has seemed to be less than the sum of its parts. If we go back to 2010, when there was ethnic violence in Kyrgyzstan, the then interim president of Kyrgyzstan asked for CSTO help to put down the riots and restore order. The CSTO balked, didn't do anything. And subsequently, there's a perception that the CSTO wasn't good for very much, that it was never going to kind of come together to actually provide concrete security assistance. The violence in Kazakhstan in January 2022 was the first time that it actually did, that it overcame that reluctance, and where you had especially Russian troops deploy outside of Russian territory on this kind of domestic security mission. And not only that, they deployed, but then they withdrew. There was concern at the time, of course, that, you know, when Russia deploys troops outside its borders, they're going to stay. But in this case, they left. And I think that was seen as an important milestone in terms of the development of the CSTO as a more capable organization, more willing to play this role. And as far as China goes, I think the view is that as long as these other mechanisms are in place for regional security, China doesn't need to step in with a very heavy hand to do that. China and Russia both have a kind of preference for authoritarian regimes, are worried about Islamism, radicalism, and want to benefit economically in the region. So I think the view in Beijing is that if the governments in Central Asia plus Russia can manage to maintain stability and help protect Chinese economic equities, then there's not a reason for Beijing to get involved in a really extensive way in the security or the politics of these countries. If that comes under question, though, and I think this is one of the consequences of the war in Ukraine that bears watching, does that mean that China is going to be more inclined or more interested in taking on a regional security role for itself if it feels that Russia, either bilaterally or through the CSTO, is no longer willing or able to fulfill that role?
That is comprehensive coverage of the regional dynamics. Thank you for that. I do want to bring up three organizations, two of which you've mentioned some already. But first is the CIS, or Commonwealth of Independent States. Second would be the CSTO, the Collective Security Treaty Organization. Both of those groups were sort of originally organized by the Russian Federation after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And then the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or SCO, another significant grouping of nations. The SCO theoretically exists to address diplomatic, economic, and security cooperation across the entire Central and East Asian region. What role does Kazakhstan specifically play in these three organizations, and how relevant are those three groupings to Kazakhstan's geostrategic position in Central Asia? And I ask that because you brought up the fact that as a huge country, it has a relatively small population, and population size matters as far as impact goes in some of these organizations that exist.
Yeah, so the CIS still exists. It doesn't do a whole lot. It was kind of created as the successor to the Soviet Union, but it never really found a role. Its existence at this point is pretty vestigial. I'll come back to this in a minute. But the CSTO, you know, we've mostly talked about. I think, you know, for Kazakhstan, the main significance of it is that when there was this political unrest in January of 2022, it turned to the CSTO for assistance. And then the CSTO jumped in and provided a relatively small number of troops. But that small number allowed Tokayev's government to show that it had the backing of the rest of the CSTO, but particularly of Russia. And this carried some weight in terms of domestic politics. So, you know, if the people who were challenging Tokayev's rule in early 2022 thought that they, you know, had a chance of unseating him or displacing him, the intervention of Russian troops, even in relatively small numbers, was kind of a signal to these opposition movements and actors that Tokayev had Moscow's backing, and that it would be dangerous for them to try and escalate the efforts to oust him. Now, that said, the CSTO was also called on to provide support for Armenia,
right,
which is also a member during the recent conflict with Azerbaijan, which is not a member. And for a variety of reasons and on a variety of pretexts, the CSTO didn't do that. And Armenia has been seeking to distance itself from the organization as a result. It's still a member, but it canceled joint military exercises that were scheduled to take place on its territory, didn't participate in the most recent summit. So I think the failure of the CSTO to get involved in the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict has kind of reinforced the message, not just to Armenia, but to the other members, that at the end of the day, they can't really count on this organization, that it's it remains subject to substantial Russian influence, that it's going to act in ways that reinforce Russian geopolitical objectives, and that it's not so much, an impartial organization that you can call on or that you can rely on to protect your security, because at the end of the day, it's going to be responsive to what Russia wants. So if the 2022 unrest in Kazakhstan was kind of a signal that, okay, the CSTO has become more of a serious organization and now has the capabilities and the willingness to deploy outside its borders, the failure to protect or to do anything really in the Armenia-Azerbaijan war reinforced a lot of the doubts that had long existed about the organization and whether you could count on it. I think again, for a country like Kazakhstan, which has had a strategy of trying to avoid giving Russia any sort of pretext for considering it a threat, there's little prospect that it'll leave the CSTO. But I think, in terms of thinking about how can the government secure its future, how can it define its interests, I don't think there's going to be a lot of willingness to see the CSTO as an important pillar or as a a bulwark for security going forward. As far as the SCO is concerned, the SCO is a big, multifaceted organization whose purpose is a little bit unclear. Russia and China are the main drivers of the organization, but now it also includes India and Pakistan and Iran. And when you have that many countries with diverging interests, it's a little hard to pin down exactly what the organization stands for or what it does. I'll say this, though. Many of the countries that are involved are authoritarian or at least not ideologically averse to working with or supporting authoritarian regimes. And they're all non-Western countries. So for a long time, the West, the liberal democratic West, has had an effective monopoly on international institutions, that the real international institutions that matter have all been designed by the West, and they all have liberal democracy written into their DNA. The SCO is one example of a new kind of non-Western multilateralism. And even if it's pretty diffuse and its purpose is a little bit undefined, the fact that it's a forum where you've got the leaders of Russia, China, India, Pakistan, the Central Asian countries, Iran, potentially Turkey down the road, joining is pretty significant just in terms of what those countries and those leaders represent, whatever it is they can agree or not agree on. And it suggests that the Russian analysts sometimes talk about the normative hegemony of the West doesn't necessarily apply anymore, and that there's a world beyond the West that's emerging with its own rules, its own institutions, and its own ideas. And that one of the key differences is that liberalism and democracy are not as instrumental for these non-Western countries, even for a democratic country like India, as they are for the West. And so I think to the extent that we're going to see the SCO developing in new ways and similar organizations emerging, I think it represents a challenge to the model of international society as designed by and implemented by the West. And then that's the main significance for it. You know, for Kazakhstan, as a Eurasian state, as an authoritarian state, being a member of a group like the SCO makes total sense. I think the fact that the SCO is not Russian dominated, that you have the presence of China and India and others, actually makes it a more comfortable venue for a country like Kazakhstan, because it has more freedom of action, more freedom of maneuver than it would in a purely Russian dominated organization, or one where Russia was playing a much more prominent role, like say the CSTO. There's one other organization that you didn't mention that I think is probably worth bringing up, and that's the Eurasian Economic Union. EEU or EAEU. This was actually something that the former Kazakh president, Nursultan Nazarbayev, proposed in the 1990s as kind of an enhanced customs union to preserve some of the supply chains and economic relationships that the collapse of the Soviet Union disrupted. It didn't really go anywhere for a while. And then in the late 2000s, the Russians started taking up this idea. Putin talked about it when he was prime minister between 2008 and 2012. And it was one of the key platforms for his campaign to return to the presidency in 2011, 2012. He talked about building the Eurasian Economic Union or he called it the Eurasian Union at the time, as a pole in an increasingly multipolar world. Many of the other countries that were slated for inclusion in the Union balked at this framing of it. One of the countries that was key to Putin's vision was Ukraine. And Ukraine, of course, was not interested, even under the comparatively pro-Russian leadership at the time of Viktor Yanukovych. And it was Ukraine's attempt to sign a trade agreement with the European Union rather than with this Russian-Eurasian Union that really sparked the crisis in Ukraine that has now spread and lasted for over a decade. But Ukraine ends up not joining this Eurasian Union or Eurasian Economic Union, as it ultimately gets called. And so instead, it becomes much more of a southern-focused entity. So in addition to Russia, there's, again, Belarus, Armenia, Kazakhstan, and now Kyrgyzstan. And these countries all have now a common sort of external tariff barrier and have lowered internal trade barriers, tariffs, and others. So for Russia, this was a way to help ensure that the smaller post-Soviet countries, especially in the Caucasus and Central Asia, remained economically connected to Russia and limited their sort of reorientation or drift out of Russia's economic orbit. You know, one example in Kyrgyzstan, in the bazaars before the signing of the agreement to join the Eurasian Economic Union, most of the goods that you would find were of Chinese origin. It was cheap. You know, you'd had shuttle traders who would go across to China, you know, buy various kinds of consumer goods, bring them back, and then, you know, sell them in the bazaars in Kyrgyzstan. And the Eurasian Economic Union was designed in part to make that harder, to reorient the trade patterns of these countries so that they would trade more with one another and more specifically with Russia and less with outside partners. And so we've definitely seen that. And it also creates complications now because of the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia over the war in Ukraine. There have been efforts, of course, to carve out the other Eurasian Economic Union members, apart from Belarus, which is an active participant in the war. But because of their deep economic ties to Russia, that has been complicated. And one of the things that we've seen just recently is a real uptick of re-export of sanctioned goods to Russia through the other Eurasian Economic Union members. And that's particularly been an issue with Kyrgyzstan, but I think we can see it with all of these countries because it's easier for them to trade with Russia. And so there's been a spike in terms of goods from, say, Europe being sold to these other Eurasian Economic Union member countries and then re-exported to Russia, even though because of sanctions, Russia is not allowed to be purchasing them. And that's a source of tension between the European Union and the Central Asian countries and between the U.S. and the Central Asian countries.
So, Professor Mankoff, you brought up the U.S. I want to go ahead and shift gears now a little bit more on the U.S. Foreign policy aspects of this whole situation. When I had Tamer Umarov and Yair Batmanghelidze on the show, they both commented on the fact or the sense of kind of a movement of regional independence across the five Central Asian republics, away from sort of you know, genuflecting to Moscow, not wanting to get completely swallowed up by Beijing, but they also don't want to, you know, bow down to Washington, D.C. And I've also read a lot, and listened to some things on like BBC radio and some other places where the younger generations across Central Asia, the Central Asian republics, they are seeking a greater connection to the rest of the world. And it's becoming much easier to do as internet spreads across the region. So with all that said, and if you look at what's been happening in the region, we've had You know, Putin has been visiting the region. We've had Pakistan, Turkey, Iranian leaders all visiting Central Asia. We've had French President Emmanuel Macron reaching out to the Central Asian republics, Olaf Scholz, our own Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has been visiting the region. Are the Central Asian nations looking to align more closely with the Western world or with China, or is it kind of both? Is this part of this this new non-aligned movement that's really been growing rapidly around the world, where countries, even India and Brazil, part of the BRICS, they want to be, you know, democracies, but they're also partnering up with strongly autocratic nations? Are we seeing these autocratic nations in Central Asia looking to connect more to the West for an economic boost, while still maintaining control? And if so, how should President Biden, how should the United States play this this situation? Again, this is your personal opinion. Mm-hmm. You're not speaking on behalf of the U.S. government.
Yeah. I think it's less about wanting to align with the West and more about being independent and pursuing their own interests. And that centers on being able to maintain a multiplicity of international engagements. And, you know, for a long time, this was a region that was seen and often treated as Russia's backyard. I think, you know, as you described, there's a younger generation that's emerging that is less under the influence of Russian culture, that's much more interested in speaking the local languages. Kazakhs who emphasize speaking Kazakh. You know, we even saw President Tokayev make a gesture in this direction where at a meeting with Putin recently, he began his speech by speaking in Kazakh for a while. That was a very demonstrative symbol that, you know, Kazakhstan has its own identity, that it doesn't see itself as being part of a Russian world. That also doesn't mean that it's, you know, seeking alignment with the West. Again, given the geography and the neighborhood in which a country like Kazakhstan is located, it can't afford to be a foe or a rival of Russia or China. And I think instead what the leadership in Astana and in the other Central Asian capitals are trying to do is to give themselves as many options as possible. You know, I think the idea of a non-aligned world is a little bit different than the classic era of the non-aligned movement during the Cold War, because I think that today these countries have a much more diverse set of interests, and we're not really in the kind of bipolar confrontation that the Cold War was. But there is a significant segment of the world that doesn't want to be told that it has to make a choice, and that wants to pursue its own strategic and economic interests. And I think the Central Asian countries very much fall into that. Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan probably the most forthright about wanting that kind of strategic independence. And so that means a lot of things. It means seeking investment from other sources to reduce their dependence not only on Russia, but also on China. It means signing energy and logistics transport partnerships with countries in Europe, which are very interested in expanding overland transit, which could be very beneficial for Central Asia. It means working closer with Turkey, which sees Central Asia in some ways as part of its own strategic space because of the cultural linkages. You know, four out of the five Central Asian countries speak Turkic languages, and their extensive cultural and economic ties. There's been a foundation or the consolidation in the last couple of years of a new organization of Turkic states driven by Ankara, in which the four Central Asian countries are participants. And you know, I think all of these partnerships are designed to emphasize that the Central Asian states are independent players, that they're not part of anybody's backyard, that they have their own interests, and that they can work with whoever is willing to work with them. I think for the U.S., the challenge is always that Central Asia is far away. It's relatively small in terms of its collective GDP, and the value of the bilateral economic relationship is comparatively limited. And so at the end of the day, you know, the U.S. is always going to have to figure out how to work with Central Asia at a time when it's not always going to be the top priority. And we've seen the Biden administration making an effort in this direction. You know, you mentioned Secretary Blinken traveling to the region. President Biden met with the five Central Asian leaders in New York around the UN General Assembly earlier this year. There's an effort underway to catalyze private investment in infrastructure as a way of competing with the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. To the extent that that's successful, I think there's going to be a push to get more American money and money from allied countries going into some of these infrastructure projects in the region, which then can help create kind of common interests around trade and development and investment. So I think there's an effort underway to be more invested in and involved in Central Asia. In the past, we've tended to prioritize the region only for security reasons. There was a big push into Central Asia after 9/11, when the U.S. had a military presence in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan during the military operations in Afghanistan. That's now been withdrawn, and I don't think it's coming back, and I don't think it should come back. But the challenge then is, how can the U.S. focus on the region, focus on areas of common interest, one, when there are other priorities, and two, when the kind of overriding security focus that's long been the driver of U.S. involvement in the region is no longer as prominent as it was in the years after as it was in the years after 9/11.
So Jeff, as I'm listening to all the things you've been telling us today, I realize there's sort of this interesting catch-22 situation with the Central Asian nations. Obviously, China's Belt and Road Initiative, the belt piece going through Central Asia, would be a great economic boost to all of those countries. The fact that European nations and the United States want to reach out to the region and help it develop economically, you know, you were just talking about some of those economic ties that are being explored. If the belt part of the Belt and Road Initiative were successful, it would actually make it easier for Europe to connect up to Central Asia and have those benefits from foreign direct investment into the region, subsequently benefit the economies in Europe and even the United States, frankly, over the long term. But for the United States, I mean, we champion the rule of law, democracy, civil rights, things like this. But we're talking about, you know, five countries in Central Asia that don't really pay heavy attention to those things that we champion around the globe. So there's this sort of collision of, philosophies about governance and economics. And I'm under the impression that a lot of the political leadership in those five countries in Central Asia personally benefit from economic development. They don't necessarily share the wealth with all of the people in the region. Any thoughts on those, on me sort of waxing poetical here?
Yeah, the Belt and Road does kind of create a dilemma, because economic development is very much needed. Investment in infrastructure in Central Asia and other parts of the world is very much needed. And we never get a lot of mileage going to these countries and telling them, China's offering you billions of dollars in much-needed investment, don't take it.
Right.
So I don't think that's the right strategy, but I think that, pushing both the government in Beijing and the government in Central Asia to promote high standards around transparency and rule of law and environmental justice around these infrastructure projects is important. And I think, you know, to the extent that the Belt and Road catalyzes the U.S. government and the U.S. private sector and the governments and private sectors in allied countries to step up their own game, to focus on investment in the region and in critical infrastructure, that's no bad thing either. And again, you know, we've seen the Biden administration talk about this. You know, we don't have the massive reserves of capital that the state can just, you know, direct to be invested the way that, that China can. So it's going to be much more of a private sector-led initiative. And in order to do that, the private sector is going to need it's going to need guarantees around the security of its investments and property rights and the ability to generate a return and to repatriate capital and to do all of these things. And I think that these are areas where the U.S. can work with the Central Asian governments to, you know, implement the kinds of reforms that would allow and would encourage private sector investment from the U.S., from Europe, from Japan, from Korea, India, wherever else, to flow into the region as well, so that we're not only talking about Chinese investment, but that China is one player among many.
Yeah, that's a great point. So, Jeff, I know you have a hard stop at 11 o'clock your time out on the East Coast in Washington, D.C. I want to ask us a few more quick questions. Any resources you'd like to point our listeners to so they can learn more about Central Asia? Any really good articles or books that you might recommend?
Oh, gosh. So the best kind of comprehensive history of the region is written by a professor out in California named Adib Khalid, K-H-A-L-I-D. It's a doorstop of a book, but I think that's a really good place to go for kind of reference to the history of the region. In terms of contemporary coverage, I really like Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and The Diplomat, which both do a pretty good job covering the region. You mentioned you had Timur Murov on there recently. You know, he's great. He's at the Carnegie Endowment and is, I think, one of the best observers of the region here in Washington. And then, actually, I guess he's not based in Washington. And then, let's see, I'm trying to think what else. There's a Central Asia program at George Washington University at the Institute for Eurasian, Russian, and European Studies. So if listeners are interested in some of the more academic analyses, they do a lot of events that are live streamed. People can watch. Those are all good places to go.
Are you personally working on any new publications, whether it be a book or articles, peer-reviewed articles, which might be forthcoming sometime soon that we can read?
I don't have anything on Central Asia coming out anytime soon, but doing some stuff on kind of Russia rethinking its role in the world as a result of the war in Ukraine and ideas for reshaping world order, which definitely has implications for Central Asia and Russia's view of where Central Asia should go.
We have just a few minutes left. I'll always like to give my guests the final word. I've taken it a little bit out of order normally here, but 2 minutes, last thoughts on Central Asia, things you want people to know about before we sign off.
That it's a region that I think we in the West and the U.S. in particular haven't spent as much time focusing on as perhaps we should, and that now is a really good time to begin doing that because the region is opening up. The importance of the region is increasing as we enter into a period of what the U.S. government describes as strategic competition with Russia and China. And as you have this younger generation of people in Central Asia that is more has more access to the outside world. More of them speak English, more of them have studied abroad or traveled abroad. And I think there's a real interest and willingness among that younger generation in having deeper connections and in being more involved in this kind of global community. And so I think the opportunities are there, and I would just encourage people to seize on them in whatever way they can, whether that's, you know, through travel or business or, you know, just learning about the region.
Sounds like public diplomacy has a great opportunity across Central Asia right now. Professor Jeff Mankoff from the National Defense University, thank you so much for joining us this morning on National Security This Week.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And folks, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. I look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. Have a great finish to week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.